Genocide is never justifiable, not even in an armed conflict, which means that those who continue to arm Israel while it is committing genocide are guilty of being complicit. And complicity is genocide is also prohibited under the Genocide Convention. So the states, part of why they are denying not only that genocide is being committed, but that war crimes and possibly crimes against the humanity are also being committed, is that they don't want to risk being accused of complicity in these crimes.
Finally, Budur, you are in Ramallah. You're in the occupied West Bank. If you can talk about what's happening in the West Bank right now, with members of the war cabinet talking about wanting to annex the whole area, what is actually happening on the ground?
Not to deflect the question, Amy, but just because this report that we worked on was not just addressed to the international community or the court, it was mainly addressed to the victims. I would just ask you to give me just a couple of seconds, really, just to talk about the victims. We interviewed 212 people in Gaza, including victims of airstrikes, people who lost their entire families, agreed to speak to us to share their experiences, their grief. We went back to interview some of those we interviewed way back in October and November. We went back to interview them in October this year to tell them about the report. And we saw how even a year after a year had passed since they lost the entirety of their families, the scars of their loss never left them. One of the parents whom we interviewed again told us, I don't want people's sympathy. I want my children back. And we know that no one can really bring his children back. But he also added that at least what we can do and what I want you to do is to fight as hell for me to get the justice that my children deserve. This is a parent who lost his wife, all of his three children, his sister and his parents. And these stories happened all over again. We also talked to people who face daily humiliation while they are waiting on queues for bread, for clean water, for hours upon hours. People who were displaced repeatedly, some were displaced for 12 times. And if anything, why these people would agree to talk to you is because they are waiting for justice, is because they believe that at least it is our duty to bear witness to the ongoing carnage and to name it for what it is, genocide. Now, concerning what's happening in the West Bank, I think all the attempts of Israel to annex more and more land from the West Bank, including through military orders, including through designated land in the West Bank and state land, is part of Israel's onslaught and full-throttled onslaught on Palestinian existence on this land, on Palestinian memory, on Palestinian presence. This fight, this onslaught takes many shapes, many forms. In Gaza, we see it in the form of genocide. In the West Bank, we see it in the form of slow but really clear disposition and mass displacement. More than 300 households have been displaced in the West Bank since the 7th of October 2023. But what is common between these among this architecture of disposition, displacement, dehumanization, be it in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem or the Gaza Strip, is Israel's ongoing attempt, with the support of the United States, to erase Palestinians from this land.
Budur Hassan, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and also comment that today is the anniversary of the death of Rafat Al-Adir. He was killed 1 year ago today in an Israeli strike. His last tweet, "The Democratic Party and Biden are responsible for the Gaza genocide perpetrated by Israel." Rafat Al-Adir is known around the world. He was a professor at Islamic University and an award-winning poet. Budur Hassan, thank you so much for being with us. I'm an Amnesty International researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. We will link to Amnesty's report, which has just concluded Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. The report is called "You Feel Like You're Subhuman, Israel's Genocide Against Palestinians in Gaza." Next up, All That Remains, a new Al Jazeera documentary, follows a 13-year-old girl named Leanne from Gaza, who lost her leg in an Israeli attack. She is now in Philadelphia, one of 1,000 child amputees in just the first 2 months of the Israeli attack on Gaza. Stay with us. Nami Lullaby by Dalal Abu Amneh. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to a grim statistic from Gaza. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Gaza now has the highest number of child amputees per capita anywhere in the world, with many children forced to endure surgery without anesthesia. In September, the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, said each day in Gaza, 10 children are losing one or both of their legs. Last weekend, after months of waiting for approval from Israel, 8 injured Palestinian children from Gaza arrived in Chicago for medical treatment. It was the largest medical evacuation of injured Palestinian children to the United States. We turn now to a new film from Al Jazeera's Fault Lines that brings this story to life. It's called All That Remains. It follows the story of Leanne Abuelata, 13-year-old girl whose leg was amputated after she was severely injured in an Israeli strike on Deir al-Balah in Gaza last December.
Leanne was like a butterfly. She flew here and there. She was very active and didn't like to stay put.
Leanne loves fashion. She loves to dress up.
Today, I have for you a poem by Tamim al-Barkuti.
She likes to write. She recites poetry.
In Jerusalem, graves are arranged as if they are lines of the city's history. Hi, guys. I'm getting ready for school because we have a test. Math.
Leanne was injured on Saturday, December 2nd.
Check this out, people. This is after I got myself ready.
The doctor told us we had to choose between the girl or her leg.
What happened to Leanne weighs very heavily on me.
To make her feel better, I tell her it isn't just you. It's this kid, that kid, that kid, and that's just who we know.
I took her cell phone to see what she used to film. I wanted to see how she used to be because I was so sad for her. What touched me when I saw her videos was that she was so ambitious. She was excited about the future and loved to document everything. This made me feel I wanted to see her like she was before, not confined to a bed.
I was awake, but I felt like I was in a dream. It didn't feel real. My name is Leanne Ali Musa Abu Al-Ata. I'm in Egypt, and we're getting ready to go to America tomorrow.
That's 13-year-old Leanne Al-Ata. In this next clip from the Fault Lines documentary, All That Remains, Leanne's parents and her older brother describe what happened after she was injured in this Israeli strike on Deir al-Balah.
It was like Leanne was fading away before our eyes. And we were watching our hopes and dreams being destroyed.
Her leg looked almost amputated. The doctor told us that the majority of her leg's tendons were cut. 10 to 15 centimeters of her bones were missing.
There wasn't any equipment for the doctors to perform proper surgery. The doctor came out and said that the girl was in very bad condition. It was clear on his face. I had a high fever that never went away, and my leg suddenly turned black and blue. I can't breathe. Enough already. We didn't know what to do. The girl was dying.
That's a clip from All That Remains, a new Al Jazeera Fault Lines documentary. Leanne is now in Philadelphia. She's being treated at Shriners Hospital. For more, we're joined from Washington, D.C. by Rana Natur. She's the director and producer of All That Remains. Rana, this is a devastating film. Yes, it's the story of one little girl and her unbelievable courage. But take us on that journey from the day last December when she was injured in this airstrike, and then how she and her mom got out of Gaza to Egypt and ended up in Philly.
You know, Leanne was injured in an airstrike, in an artillery strike on a mosque that happened to be by the school where she was sheltering. And it changed the trajectory of her life forever and her loved ones and her family's life, but it didn't even register on international media's reporting because of all the massacres that were going on. And after that strike, her family saw that her leg was at risk of being amputated. And they couldn't get the care they needed to get the medical care to prevent that amputation from happening. So her brother, her older brother, Ayub, launched a social media campaign. He reached out to every journalist in Gaza in an effort to make a public plea to get his sister out of Gaza. And they were successful, but it was too late. Her leg was amputated because gangrene had reached up to her leg and was going to kill her if she didn't amputate that leg. And Leanne, for every Leanne that is able to leave Gaza, there are hundreds, if not thousands, who are not able to leave. A medical evacuation out of Gaza and her eventual medical evacuation to the U.S. for medical treatment, it's what I call a lucky ticket for the profoundly unlucky. But it was the best shot that Leanne had at a future. It was the best shot that Leanne had for the chance, even just the chance to be able to walk again on prosthetics.
So her leg was amputated in Cairo because the gangrene threatened her life when she got out of Gaza. Her mother making this devastating decision to leave her other children and her husband, who remain under, to say the least, in enormous danger in Gaza, but to be with Leanne.
Yes, exactly. These evacuations are essential because the medical system in Gaza is collapsing. But what this does is it means that these families are ripped away from their support system at the exact moment they need it most, when they have a very sick child that needs medical treatment. At the beginning of this journey of making the film, we thought we were following a medical journey. We wanted to know all about her treatments, and we realized soon after that this was about more than that, that this was not just about a girl who wanted to walk again, but that this was about a girl who wanted to make sure that her life didn't go unlived, that she didn't just languish in a hospital bed, and that this was a journey and something that changed the entire trajectory of this family. Every single member of this family's life changed as a result of this injury. Her mother had to make the decision. She did not want to leave Gaza, but she had to try to save her daughter's life, essentially. She left behind an 8-year-old boy who suddenly didn't have a mom. She left behind her husband, who remains in Gaza today. And we were able to document, with the help of Media Town Productions, who documented the family that Leanne left behind, this 360-degree perspective of what this injury did, because it's not just an injury that's physical to one girl, but it's a traumatic injury of separation for an entire family.
I wanted to go to another clip from your documentary, Rana, All That Remains, where we hear from the renowned surgeon, Dr. Hassan Abusita, who spent more than a month in Gaza working with Doctors Without Borders in the early days of Israel's assault there.
So this is a photo that I took of our operating room after I finished. And the anesthetist is waking the child up, and one of the nurses is writing the child's name on the box that has their amputated limb. And you can see the box where the limb is in. This is a limb that's unsalvageable and needed amputation. This is a surgery that I did on the hand to try to salvage the limb. This is a 14-year-old boy called Ramadan. So there are lots of reasons why I take these photographs. Sometimes the memories are so horrendous that you need to see it to believe that it did happen. It was really the scale. So the scale of children's amputations, half of my cases were always children. The delay that was happening in taking patients to the operating room meant that these wounds became infected and gangrenous, and you had to do amputations to save the children's lives. And as the war progressed and children knew of other children who'd lost their limbs, they would come to the operating room screaming, "Don't take my leg away, don't take my leg away." Children are not small adults. There's a difference in the way you treat them. The child's body is programmed to grow. Even the injured child's body is programmed to grow. A child that has a war-related amputation needs between 9 and 12 surgeries by the time they reach adult age. This growing child needs a new prosthetic every 6 months as their body outgrows the length of the prosthesis. This problem is so complex, so you need to create a system that ensures that these children have the most productive life possible. It is of paramount importance that we continue to plan for tomorrow, because genocide is about there not being a tomorrow. There is a tomorrow for these children. And our job is to make sure that they do not spend the rest of their lives in pain and misery as a result of this injury.
That's renowned surgeon Dr. Hassan Abusita, who spent more than a month in Gaza working with Doctors Without Borders. You can see our interviews with him at democracynow.org. But that's from the film All That Remains, that's produced and directed by Rana Natour. So let's talk about the number of Palestinian children who have lost their limbs. In fact, you document in a piece that you write, Rana, you told the story of another teenager, little young girl named Leanne also, who lost both her limbs. The Leanne who is in this documentary is at Shriners in Philadelphia right now. And Leanne Albas is at Shriners in Chicago. Rana.
That's correct. And I think when I first started reporting on this issue, I thought that the mountain that these kids were climbing medically was getting them access to a prosthetic limb and making sure that they had specialized care from specialized doctors who would be able to make that all happen. What I soon learned with the story of Leanne Albaz, which I document in the Atavist magazine, is that these injuries are incredibly complicated and difficult to treat in the best of circumstances, even before these specialists that are renowned throughout the entire world. And why? The reason is because, A, children historically didn't typically survive these injuries. And they are surviving multiple very severe and complicated injuries. To give you an idea of Leanne Albaz, she has an above-the-knee amputation on one knee, and a below-the-knee amputation in another knee. That she had limbs that she's a victim of a blast injury. So these limbs have been eviscerated. The limbs, the bones, the muscles, the tissue, the tendons, the skin. There's a specialist for each of those things because they all have to work together in order to accommodate a prosthetic. And when she finally was able to walk on a prosthetic, I was able to witness what that therapy looks like. She's operating basically two different instruments at the same time. She has to learn how to master two different instruments because she has a mechanical knee on one side and she has a prosthetic that looks completely different on the other side because the injuries look completely different. It is very, very, very difficult.
So we have to wrap up right now. We have 30 seconds. The documentary, All That Remains, just utterly heartbroken with the divided family. And the strongest figure in this film is this little girl, is Leanne, who is comforting her mother, who came with her, her dad, who's still in Gaza, her brothers. Her spirit is astounding.
It absolutely is. I mean, these kids survived bombs being dropped on them, buildings falling on them, shrapnel ripping through their body, and they survived all of this, and they still have the fight to fight for their future and demand they have one. It sounds like it's a depressing story, but I promise you it's a hopeful one.
Rana Natour, I want to thank you for being with us, director and producer of the Fault Lines documentary, All That Remains, and all should see it. We'll also link to your article and activist called Coming to America. Coming up in 20 seconds, we go to France, where President Macron is refusing to resign, even though lawmakers across the political spectrum have united and ousted his prime minister. Back in 20 seconds.
Much unhappy about that. I hate to come down to the level and become a BW, a basic woman. But if they don't stop, it's gonna get scandalous. I don't need this.
I'll be back real soon.
That's what I get for being in the neighborhood.
Got a meeting in the ladies' room.
Where's my jewelry? Can we talk?
I don't know, but I think you better watch your man.
Better watch your man.
Meeting in the Ladies' Room by Climax. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to France, where it is in political turmoil after leftists and far-right lawmakers united to oust Prime Minister Michel Barnier in a no-confidence vote Wednesday. The vote came amidst intense opposition to Barnier's budget proposal and its roughly $60 billion in spending cuts and tax increases, the first time France's government has fallen to a no-confidence vote since 1962. On Thursday, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, rejected calls to resign, said he'll soon name a new prime minister.
We cannot allow ourselves to be divided or to do nothing. That's why I will name a prime minister in the coming days. I will ask them to form a government in the general interest, representing all the political parties who can participate in it, or at least who agree not to bring it down.
We're joined now from Marseille, France, by Cole Stengler, journalist covering politics and labor issues in France. His most recent book, Paris is Not Dead, Surviving Hyper-Gentrification in the City of Life, in the City of Light. Thank you so much, Cole, for being with us. Talk about what's taken place. This is historic.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Like you said, it's the first time that we've had a government fall to a motion of no confidence since 1962. This is the shortest lived government really in the history of the Fifth Republic. And we're in this unprecedented situation of turmoil. And I think, you know, we can look back for deeper reasons to try to understand the political crisis that France is in. But if you want to look at it a little bit more simply, you know, this comes down to really two big factors here. One is we have to go back to President Macron's decision to dissolve the National Assembly this summer, a move that might go down as, you know, probably one of the greatest own goals, let's say, in French political history. So Macron, when he dissolved the National Assembly, what that meant is we went to new elections, and In those new elections, the National Front, the National Rally, excuse me, the far-right National Rally increased its share. Macron's party decreased its share. And so it left a situation which we had three main blocks in the National Assembly, none of which was able to form a majority of their own. So Macron lost, self-inflicted wound, lost his relative majority in the National Assembly by calling for those elections. And then secondly, again, to get back to Macron's responsibility here, secondly, the crisis has its roots in the way that Macron responded to those elections. So like I said, after those elections, we had three blocks in the National Assembly, the left bloc, the New Popular Front, with a slight lead on the rest, but basically three evenly split blocks. And instead of turning to the parties that, instead of turning to what the voters expressed at the polls, which was support for the center and for the left, Macron decided to name a prime minister on the right. So a prime minister that did not actually reflect what voters expressed at the polls. So it's really those two big issues to simplify. It's one, Macron's decision to call those elections in the first place, which backfired, decreased his party share in the National Assembly. And secondly, the fact that this government here that's fallen did not reflect what voters actually expressed at the polls earlier this summer.
So Barnier is a former EU official. He's been forced to step down as prime minister. The president says he's going to name a new prime minister. Can you talk about who exactly he's talking to? You have everyone from Marine Le Pen on the far right to Mathilde Panot, leader of the left-wing France Unbowed party. And Marine Le Pen, who now faces a verdict in a criminal embezzlement case in the next months, which could potentially make her ineligible to run for office for years. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that also might be part of the reason why there's calls to move to a presidential election in certain parts of the far right. But you know, the key issue here is we still have the same mathematical problem that we had after the elections this summer, which is how do you find a prime minister that's able to get enough support in the National Assembly, or that's able to at least withstand a motion of no confidence. So you have to get someone who cannot have 289 members of the National Assembly vote against them. That's really the goal here. And the question is Macron going to basically try to do the same thing that he did this summer, which is to say, I'm going to turn to the right and de facto let the National Rally be the one that's going to decide whether or not to let to have the government stand or not? Or is he going to turn to the left? That's what the members of the National, the New Popular Front, the left-wing coalition have been calling for. But to be quite frank, Amy, if you look at the way that Macron spoke last night, it doesn't seem like we're going to have a change of tack. It doesn't seem like we're moving to that Macron wants to name a left-wing prime minister. But again, the main situation here is at a certain point, it's not really Macron's decision to make. We have a mathematical problem. France needs to have a government, and you have three pretty evenly split blocks. So at some point, that mathematical reality requires choices to be made.
And finally, Cole Stangler, you have President-elect Trump going to France in his first international trip since he was reelected president for the reopening after the fire of Notre Dame Cathedral.
Yeah, I mean the timing there is quite remarkable because we have a president now, you know, President Macron. I mean, you could maybe say that both these presidents are in very different, or future president in the case of Trump, in different situations. Macron is increasingly isolated, extremely unpopular. If you look at his,
we have 10 seconds.
Extremely unpopular president, increasingly isolated. So Macron not in a very favorable position right now.
Cole Stangler is a journalist speaking from the French city of Marseille, and we'll link to your articles. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Anjali Kamat, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias, our executive director, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live nationwide, offering a confidential multilingual service 24/7 to connect human trafficking victims and survivors with social and emergency services. We welcome calls if you have tips, concerns, or questions about human trafficking in your community. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call the hotline now. at 1-833-900-1010.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.